You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
With the last of the American forces now out of Iraq, most observers agree that the political and social stability of the country remain uncertain, although there has been a considerable reduction in violence and death since the height of the insurgent fighting in 2006. And that, in great part, is due to that year's Sunni Awakening, which involved U.S. forces working jointly with former insurgents and tribal leaders to fight al-Qaeda. In his latest book, award-winning historian William Doyle tells the story of the late Captain Travis Patrick Quinn and his key contributions to the efforts on the ground that launched the awakening in Anbar province. A Soldier's Dream, Captain Travis Patrick Quinn and the Awakening of Iraq is published by New American Library Caliber or the Penguin Press or whatever you want to call it. And I'm very pleased to welcome William Doyle to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
How was the awakening conceived and who were the key players at first?
The awakening was launched by Iraqi Sunni tribal chiefs, many of them rural and obscure characters, and shady characters in some cases, who were fed up with al-Qaeda's conquering and controlling strategic Anbar province.
But why would Sunni tribal leaders want to fight the al-Qaeda insurgency, which involved Sunni resistance to the new Shiite majority government?
Very few times in history has al-Qaeda conquered and held a large city of 400,000, for example, like Ramadi was, the capital of Anbar province. Once they did that, their institution of strict Islamic law and a parallel government offended the tolerant, authentic Muslims of Anbar province, I would argue, so much that they reacted against it and joined with American forces, Leonard, not only as a bulwark against al-Qaeda in a way of getting them out, because al-Qaeda was destroying the business, destroying their lives of the local Sunni Muslims once they took over, but also as a way, as a bulwark against Shia domination and against the Maliki government. That it was a defensive, desperate maneuver that our forces joined in, and Captain Travis Patrick Quinn was really the key liaison at the key moment of the U.S. side helping the awakening begin.
And where does the awakening get its name from?
That was generated by a man I call Iraq's Tony Soprano, an alleged gangster, shady character, but a very charismatic and visionary young sheikh, obscure sheikh, his name was Sheikh Sattar Abu Risha, who became almost literally a blood brother of Travis Patrick Quinn in their efforts to launch the awakening and to transform the province and eventually Iraq.
Well, some in the U.S. military didn't trust that sheikh. You compare him to Tony Soprano. Does that mean he really was a mobster of a sort?
He described himself as being in the import, export, and construction businesses, much like Tony Soprano. He was widely believed by U.S. intelligence to be at least a smuggler of various things, and many sheikhs in Iraq were. That was the only thing you could make a dollar at. He was, in fact, Patrick Quinn and his colleagues were ordered not to deal with Sattar by higher-ups in the chain of command because Sattar was so dangerous.
So what led Patrick Quinn to trust him, and vice versa, what led Sattar to trust Patrick Quinn?
Well, Patrick Quinn was an extraordinary character. He died in an IED explosion at age 32, but it was 8 months after he had been waging this campaign, this eventually victorious campaign with Sattar and their colleagues. But Patrick Quinn was a former Special Forces soldier. He was a decorated Afghanistan combat hero. And unusually for an American, he spoke colloquial street Arabic. And he looked like an Arab man. He grew a thick black mustache, and he even fooled some Iraqis into thinking that he was an Iraqi who left and then came back.
Because Arabic has many different dialects, and they can spot right away whether you're from Morocco or Egypt or whether you learned it in some American university. How did he pick it up?
Well, he was a connoisseur. He was madly in love with the Middle East, Iraqi, with Arab culture, and with Islamic studies. He was a self-taught Quranic scholar who could quote the Quran properly in conversation with sheikhs, which is an extraordinary feat. And, he thought that al-Qaeda could be defeated. He actually thought that Islam was our greatest ally in defeating al-Qaeda, which is a tremendous insight.
When did you first hear about him?
Well, the great journalist Martin Fletcher did an article in the London Times in 07 talking about how Iraqis were remembering an American soldier as a martyr for Iraq. And I thought, that's extraordinary. There might be a story here. And he eventually, you know, I called Travis Patrick when the Lawrence of Arabia of the Iraq War. Sometimes I worried about that phrase. I didn't want to diminish it. You know, I didn't want to become diminished. But actually, I was with an Iraqi general a couple of weeks ago in Washington, and he said, I think of Travis Patrick as a Lawrence of Arabia type character. He plunged very deeply into the culture. He loved the culture, and Iraqis adored him, according to them.
When he first arrived in Ramadi, which is the capital of Anbar province, what was the U.S. military strategy against the insurgents like?
Well, the strategy led by General Casey had been, and you can understand how he came to this. He basically was saying, the more we go out and roll around and crush things with our tanks, and the more visible we are, the more fire we feed to the insurgency. And what hadn't been accomplished yet was an attempt to really, the classic clear, hold, and build counterinsurgency strategy, which you can rarely afford. You rarely have enough soldiers to do that.
But this was also one of the most violent places in Iraq.
It was prehistoric mayhem. Everything had completely collapsed, and it was pure anarchy. But in May of 2006, when Patrick Quinn got there, Sattar and the sheikhs were ready to start fighting against al-Qaeda. It was a kind of a tipping point or a high watermark for al-Qaeda.
How many different tribal groups were in and around Ramadi are there now?
You know, Iraqi tribal politics are incredibly complex. There was one big confederation called the Dulemi Confederation. The CIA, interestingly, had been in touch with Iraqi sheikhs in Anbar province since before the war and cultivating some of them, including Sattar, as a source of information and potential allies, but never did the right set of cards line up to actually where we would have enough strength and they would have enough courage to actually make a stand.
Well, did they get along with each other?
No, that's one of the big stories, is that a lot of this fighting, Leonard, is intertribal smuggling disputes, criminal disputes, and family disputes that are impenetrable to Americans to understand. I don't think any American does. But what Sattar was able to do was to chant. See, most of the big sheikhs had run away to Jordan, Qatar, Syria.
I'd imagine there was some insurgents within these tribal groups as well.
People thought that Sattar was playing games and doing business with the insurgents. That was one of the fears, is that, you know, you do business with the Americans, you take their money by day, and at night you're sending men out to blow them up for $200 a month for al-Qaeda. That was a big fear.
That's what happened in Afghanistan with some of the warlords.
Sure. What was different, though, was the receptivity of, for example, Islamic clerics in Ramadi. Al-Qaeda had thrown all the moderate imams out of the mosques. And Patrick Quinn and Sattar said, if we can somehow get the mosques involved in throwing Al-Qaeda out, and a death squad actually came in, a tribally driven death squad, started fighting against Al-Qaeda using Al-Qaeda tactics, night raids, masks, public assassinations, lists in the mosque, etc. And this death squad, which some thought was linked with Sattar, really struck fear for the first time in the Iraq War into the Al-Qaeda mentality.
My guest is William Doyle, whose latest book is A Soldier's Dream, Captain Travis Patrick Quinn and the Awakening of Iraq, published by the Penguin Group. You write about the transfer of authority in Iraq at the time that Captain Patrick Quinn arrived. What had the U.S. military been able to accomplish there up until that point?
Very little that actually held or that was tangible. They tried very hard to reach out to tribal sheikhs. There were a number of people died in that effort.
He had a predecessor who made that attempt. Why was he less successful?
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Mike McLaughlin was with the previous unit. He was called the Golden Colonel by the Iraqi sheikhs. They loved him. They adored him almost as much as Patrick Quinn. You know, smiling Irish character from Pennsylvania who tried to get the sheikhs to rise up. And what happened was he was killed in a bomb, in an attack in January 2006. The key to all this, Leonard, was getting young Iraqi men to join the police force and not plant IEDs for $200 a month for al-Qaeda, which was their only job choice at this point.
And joining the police force is dangerous anyway, because whether you also work for al-Qaeda or you don't, you are likely to be targeted by al-Qaeda.
And the police were the key to changing the order of battle. They had 3,000 slots were budgeted by the Iraqi government and by us. 100 were showing up versus 3,000 budgeted. Once Patrickwin, his colleagues, and Sheikh Sattar started convincing tribal sheikhs to send young men into the police by the dozens and the hundreds, and eventually by the score of 3,000, suddenly the order of battle is tipped, and you can make an impact against al-Qaeda.
You've read many of Captain Patrickwin's writings. He wasn't the person devising strategies in Iraq, but you've supplied us with two documents that he did write. I gather he hated writing reports.
He was a lousy staff officer. He hated sitting in an office and writing reports. And you can Google Travis Patrickwin PowerPoint, and you'll see a famous funny, silly, but very insightful analysis of the Iraq War that he did in PowerPoint as a big Bronx cheer to PowerPoints.
Well, if he really wasn't devising strategies and had to answer to his superiors, how did he manage to be so important be able to interact with all these players and be trusted and affect real policy?
Well, things were in such disastrous shape in Anbar province. His commanding officers, chiefly Colonel Sean McFarland, then Colonel, and then Lieutenant Colonel Jim Lechner, realized that this young Arabic-speaking, immensely charismatic, funny, humble, you know, Islam-loving, Arabic-loving man was the key to the heart of a personal relationship with the sheikhs, the last remaining neighborhood power brokers, and they let him run with it. And it was an accident of history that Patrickwin was given basically this much power and influence, and it's to their credit that they let him do it.
In order to gain Iraqi favor, what were the Americans actually offering the young men in order to have them join the Iraqi police?
Well, first, they changed the plan so that they would be protected more, they would be trained faster outside of the outside of their towns, and they would be sent back quicker. And it was because the sheikh said, okay, it's okay now to cooperate with the coalition.
But there was also fear that we would be creating tribal militias. Forget about whether they would work with al-Qaeda. They still might work independently of American interest or the interests of the government in Baghdad.
Well, there are scenes in my book that were lost to history until I found the interpreters who were in the room, because Patrickwin's Arabic was kind of rough, and he always had interpreters sitting in the back. He'd say, hey, guys, you know, back me up, help me out here. And those interpreters told me of dialogues that Sattar had with Patrickwin on exactly that point. Sattar said, I want my own force. Give me my own force. Give me guns and money. I will clean out this province.
But he was talking like a warlord. In fact, are there warlords in Iraq, or is that something that we only associate with places like Afghanistan?
Warlords of influence and money, but really not. We never really allowed militias to be stood up, and that was a big fear that civilian policymakers had. I mean, from day one, Paul Bremer was saying, his CPA was saying, don't deal with sheikhs. He'll tell you differently. But effectively,
well, he keeps on changing the history of his role in the Iraqi story. He came on our show, and we had documents that said the opposite of what he was saying at that time.
I'm not surprised. I can't figure him out. I mean, you know, he told me, interestingly, he said, listen, if I hadn't de-Ba'athified, you know what would have happened, Bill? The next day, the Kurds would have broken away, and there would have been more bloodshed, because they told me that they were going to, and they wouldn't have broken away at all. I mean, he's a very naive, interesting man, I think, in many ways. But, you know, Patrickwin hated what Bremer did. He disagreed with the strategy being pursued then by President Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld, and held them responsible for misjudgments that were made before the war and after the invasion.
So were they screening these young men who they were enlisting for the police?
Oh, yes. But Patrickwin said to Sattar, listen, if we can't prove that they have killed American soldiers, we'll let them in. The reason is because they're in this situation, everybody's got blood on their hands. He was right.
Because some of the tribal recruits were on the American military's most wanted list, weren't they?
I wouldn't say that at all, really. But we were negotiating with insurgents. Another big part in the document that you're posting on your website, you'll see that Patrickwin thought that we should negotiate with reconcilable insurgents. Now, that was not an original, stunningly original idea, but he was, Sattar was doing it at the local level, and there's a summit meeting in my book. There's a summit meeting between Sattar and the top reconcilable or nationalist insurgent in Anbar province in September 2006, where they agreed to stop fighting the Americans and to start channeling huge numbers of fighters into the police. A big tipping point.
Who was paying their salaries?
The CIA started with offering bonus payments. It was a very effective lubricant in the summer of 2006. The CIA people at that station showed up with suitcases full of cash, enabling bonuses to be paid to these young men coming into the police force. Normally, it's very hard to pay these guys because you have to literally take. At that point, you had to fly American cash in a helicopter chain from Baghdad out to Anbar province and get it distributed. It's kind of a big mess. But the CIA had deeper pockets to dig into, and they're more flexible with the accounting.
And is that still the case?
I don't know.
Do we know
that.
Who's paying these guys?
No. Well, the CIA is still very involved in Iraq. I can't speak for what they're doing now.
Wasn't everything supposed to be paid for by Iraqi oil? That never happened.
Well, actually, Leonard, the salary, the regular salaries of the Iraqi police was paid for by the Iraqi government. That was done very above board, and Patrick Quinn and his colleagues wanted to do it the right way and to do it by the letter of the law, and that was very important to them, and Sattar agreed to that.
Now, how did Sheikh Sattar gain prominence among all these tribal leaders? He was no more respected than any of the others, was he?
Well, he was a wheeler-dealer. He was an operator. Most of his competitors had run away. There was nobody left there. He's the last guy standing, basically, and he had nothing to lose. Al-Qaeda, by the way, had killed four of his close relatives, brothers, his father. So this was a revenge motivation with him, too, not just trying to get construction contracts and so forth.
You describe Patrick Quinn as kind of being conflicted. He wanted to get out of Iraq. At the same time, he had made a major commitment to the Iraqi people.
He wanted to win. He thought we could win. And in 2006, nobody was thinking that. Very few people were thinking that, I think, saw the future that eventually happened, where you had radical reductions in violence and the whole thing didn't fall apart. It looked like it was in 2006. But, Patrick Quinn, he loved Iraq to a really large extent, and he loved the army, and he wanted his family, and he wanted you and I as Americans to be proud of the work that he was doing with his colleagues there. And some of it was unbelievable. They were running cities. Young 25-year-old captains were running cities, power plants, and all these impossible jobs we asked them to do. So I think he's kind of a symbol for the great work that was done and is lost to history by many young American men and women.
My guest is William Doyle. His book, A Soldier's Dream, Captain Travis Patrick Quinn and the Awakening of Iraq. You write that one of the critical moments in the awakening was the Battle of Sufia. Why? What was that battle all about?
The Battle of Sufia is a micro Gettysburg or Pickett's Charge, or literally the high watermark of al-Qaeda's power in Iraq, you could argue, in November of 2006. The top al-Qaeda commander in the nation of Iraq decided to enter the Ramadi area and kill the awakening by doing a light infantry sweep and clear of a peninsula that was pivotal. It's called Shark's Fin Peninsula, where a sheikh there was starting to cooperate with the Iraqi government and with us. And the decision was made to wipe them out with small arms and kind of a foot march north on this peninsula. And at the key moment, Travis Patrick Quinn was in the control center, the tactical operations center, and it was a big mess, and we were trying to figure out how to save this sheikh who had recently come over to our side. He had a couple dozen men, a couple dozen guns, outgunned completely, backs to the wall, literally to the wall next to the Euphrates River, when Sheikh Jassim gets on the phone with Travis Patrick Quinn, and they figure out a way of getting our aircraft to figure out who's who. And that moment, where Patrick Quinn is talking in Arabic to that man on the satellite phone, is credited by some as being the turning point within that battle. And after that battle, al-Qaeda had to retreat in stages, in a bloody retreat from Ramadi that continued into the next year.
And you say that was a turning point for the war in general.
According to Sheikh Sattar, it was. According to many of the key players inside from on our side, it really was. And, the Battle of Sufia, Sheikh Jassim later told me, he said, you know, Travis Patraquin was our greatest ally, and he is a martyr for us. He's an American martyr, Bible, and he's our blood brother.
Well, you can win a battle, but how did it gain enough momentum to spread across the whole country?
Well, that was a long series of what that did was it the success of the awakening in Ramadi inspired other Sunni tribal sheikhs to start joining forces with the Iraqi government and with the Americans. Finally, they had a way of defending in a power balance way against al-Qaeda and against the Maliki government. And they saw a way of generating jobs, economic development, income, and some kind of stability in these completely decimated localities around Iraq. And the awakening, Leonard, inspired General Petraeus to do a different program called the Sons of Iraq, which is where we, the Americans, directly paid young Sunni men to go out on patrol. And that provided a breathing space. It did not lead to political reconciliation, tragically, but it did give a breathing space in the violence.
And did it pretty much succeed? Were there still some people who did what the American military brass had feared at the start? Were there turncoats, or has this pretty much been a success?
Well, it kind of reminds me, at the end of the story of Lawrence in Damascus, where things start to fall apart, and bickering among key players reverses some of the gains that were made. In Iraq, I think it succeeded halfway. The awakening has been betrayed to an extent by the fact that many of the 90,000 young men in the Sons of Iraq program who were supposed to have been absorbed into the security forces have not been absorbed. Many of them have not, they've been kind of turned out and forgotten. They are a powder keg. They could turn against the government at any time, and we have to pay close attention to that, try to help them if we can.
Because they're Sunni and the government is still dominated by Shiites?
And the government is rightly skeptical of the fact that some of these men were al-Qaeda, blood-drenched killers, and it's kind of hard to, they're hard to sort out sometimes.
You mentioned earlier that Captain Patraquin was killed by an IED explosion. And how long after the awakening did that occur?
The awakening was launched in September of 06, and he died in the first week of December. But he and his colleagues, Megan McClung, a Marine major, and his assistant specialist, Vincent Pomonte, they all saw things starting to turn around. They saw things starting to turn around. And, Travis Patraquin, to me, Leonard, teaches us two great lessons, I think. One is, a great form of American patriotism is the ability to connect to other cultures, to be inspired by them, to be modest with them, and to inspire people around the world to do great things with America. And the other big lesson, I think, is that authentic Islam is our greatest ally. If we took the time, he thought that our inability to separate good Islam from bad Islam made us look like fools in Iraq. And I think that does around the world. When we don't take the time to understand who our allies are and who our enemies are, and allow, bin Laden to define Islam for us. That's a tragic, tragic error. And Patraquin was a true believer in authentic, tolerant Islam as a, brother religion to all the other religions. A fascinating perspective on Islam.
Sheikh Sattar was killed a couple of years later by insurgents, by al-Qaeda?
It's believed that al-Qaeda bribed a relative of his bodyguard to plant an IED in his own property, and his SUV got blown up, and Sattar was killed a couple of days after realizing one of his life's dreams, which was to meet George Bush at an American airbase in Anbar province. Sheikh Sattar was emerging, Leonard, as a powerful character, not only in Iraqi politics, but in Gulf politics. He was like a shooting star, and he was a fascinating, potentially unifying force.
Within the military, there's some disagreement as to who deserves credit for the awakening. Is it fair to credit its success to one or even a few individuals?
I'm very skeptical of turning points in history. People say, well, if Robert E. Lee had punched through the clump of trees at Pickett's Charge, Abe Lincoln would have come out in his nightcap and pajamas and surrendered the United States to him shortly thereafter. No, I think he would have been defeated a few miles east of the clump of trees, that sort of thing. But you can look at certain people in certain moments in history as tremendously important. I was told by many of Patraquin's colleagues that if Patraquin hadn't done what he did, they would not have succeeded at all at that moment. And it was a critical moment. And I think you can argue that while things may have happened the same way they did, Patrick Lynn may have been an absolutely critical player. And, you know, the CIA people will tell you, hey, we were responsible. We were there for 4 years. The Marines in, you know, headquarters will tell you, well, we've been all the groundwork and the momentum had been developed elsewhere. And, you know, this was a lucky break with Sitar. But I think
General Petraeus would want some credit himself.
I talked to Petraeus extensively. He knew about Patrick Lynn. He read the document that you're posting on your website. Petraeus read a view from Ramadi, from Camp Ramadi, when Petraeus was, in the United States and Patrick Lynn was in Iraq. And he said, Petraeus said, this document makes a lot of sense. I like this thinking. And Petraeus gave very good credit to McFarland and Patrick Lynn and their colleagues for setting things up in 06 to allow the famous surge to happen. I don't think you have one without the other.
So now we have a situation where the U.S. military has gotten out of Iraq. And how has what Patrick Lynn was involved with held up? You suggested earlier, it kind of has disintegrated, but has it totally fallen apart? Or are there still segments where he would be proud?
I think he'd be very proud. It's in a weird halfway zone. He dreamed that the resorts at Lake Habaniya, the hotels in the resorts near Ramadi, would fill up with vacationing families and from Baghdad, and that the markets would open and that the streets would flourish. And some of that has really started to happen, thanks to the awakening and everything that's happened after it. But, of course, it's still in this volatile, pre-embryonic political state that may blow up at any moment. I don't think it will. I think the Iraqis will surprise us all.
Who's taken over Sheikh Sitar's role?
His brother.
Is he similar?
No, he does not have his brother's charisma. I think his brother, Ahmed Abu Risha, feels very... he feels very badly at the current political situation in Iraq. The awakening, it's a story that really has yet to be told, but I think that Patrick Lynn and his colleagues have a lot to be proud about. And, you know, what soldiers do you know about in the Iraq War? I know of none. Petraeus, and that's about it. But, again, Patrick Lynn is a symbol for thousands of people who served there, 4,400 who died there, trying to get the nation in a prosperous direction, and I think maybe it will emerge that way.
William Doyle's book, A Soldier's Dream, Captain Travis Patrick Lynn and the Awakening of Iraq, is published by the Caliber book imprint of Penguin Press. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Leonard.
Up next, David Hanna describes the battle between two sailing ships, the Boxer and the Enterprise, that marked, I'm afraid to say this after our previous conversation, a turning point in the War of 1812 and was one of the last battles of its kind ever to be fought. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Stay with us.